This is an ad by BetterHelp. What's your perfect night? Is it curling up on the couch for a cozy, peaceful night in? Therapy can feel a bit like that, your comfort place where you replenish your energy. With BetterHelp, get matched with a therapist based on your needs, entirely online. It's convenient and suited to your schedule. Find comfort this season with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.
This is Too Many Minutes, a One Heat Minute Productions podcast miniseries cracking the code of Phil Alden Robinson's 1992 tech caper, Sneakers. To decode this evergreen, era-bridging, infinitely rewatchable masterpiece, we're splitting the film into its component parts, much like its multi-generational ensemble cast for the ages. Since seeing Sneakers in cinemas all the way back in 1992, I've been trying to deconstruct the alchemy. Why does every single element harmonize so perfectly? Is it the score, the compositions, the performances, the script, the setting, the subject, the actors? After 32 years, I finally cracked it. I found Janus's little black box.
Don't look, listen.
The addition of each new cast member, each new voice, each new tone, what's on the page doesn't just bring them together, rather it becomes the framework to support what all these actors mean then and mean now to movie lovers across the decades. Phil Alden Robinson becomes a music producer as much as a director, remixing and sampling these performances, turning up the volume on their very specific music. This is a supergroup, so let's dig in and see how each bar, each sample, makes Sneakers a best of album at the jump. In episode 4, you're going to hear from author, screenwriter, and podcaster Lee Zachariah. You can hear from author of The Cinema of Paul Thomas Anderson, American Apocrypha, and host of Pod Thomas Anderson, Ethan Warren. You're going to hear from one of the greatest living film critics, Walter Chaw. And finally, you're going to hear from the co-writer and director of Sneakers, Phil Alden Robinson. Where'd I get all these great guests? I stole them from Mother's Wallet. Let's continue my conversation with Phil Alden Robinson about River Phoenix and the imps on the Sneakers set.
I can imagine there was like, there's some kind of, I don't know, unquantifiable chemistry of all these guys who are so happy to be working with each other. How did you even keep control of them? They must have just been having too much fun.
There were moments when one could not keep control of them. I'll tell you two moments. One is, River and Strathairn and Aykroyd formed this little unholy trio who were always, they were very mischievous and they always were giggling with each other. And we knew that something was going on that we weren't privy to. They had nicknames for each other. Sort of, they had like a secret language practically. And River one day outside the stage was throwing a football around with somebody. And one of the studio security people said, "Hey, you stop that." And River, because he had been hanging out with the boys so much, kind of got a little carried away and flipped the guy off or something, and was essentially arrested by the studio security people. And we had to say, no, he's the star of the film, please let him go. But there was a day on the set, I think it's when Redford says, "No, everybody has to stay here tonight."
Yes.
Sydney walks off camera, and he had to sort of make what was a very difficult off-camera move because there was no room to get around the desk he was at. And on the very first take, he did it so gracefully that off-camera, River and Strathairn just started laughing. They burst out laughing, and it ruined the take. And Sydney looked over to them like, what are you doing? And they both got so sheepish. They said, oh, Sydney, we're so sorry. We could not believe how gracefully you made this little move that no one but us will ever see. They said it was just a thing of beauty. It just made us so happy to see. So I asked them to control themselves, and we did it again. But the Danny and River and Davis Trithairn had so much fun together. They were like a little gang.
Yes.
Of mischief makers. They were the imps on the set.
Before we get to our next guest, there's a little story that I want to share. Kiefer Sutherland, who starred in Rob Reiner's 1986 film, Stand By Me, with River Phoenix, believes that he and River Phoenix helped generate the change of title from Stephen King's The Body to Stand By Me. One night, they were singing the song on the set that you're hearing swelling up right now, and Rob Reiner said, oh God, I haven't heard that for 20 years. Let's listen to a little bit of the song from Benny King, and then we'll come back and talk again with Walter Chaw and Ethan Warren about River Phoenix's legacy, starting with Stand By Me.
Yeah, well, he was, you know, I think the tragedy of looking for the next James Dean is that James Dean, part of James Dean is he died after three movies in a few television hours. And the sort of winsomeness of that, the legend of that, you know, the lost potential of it, I think has to play a lot into it. And there's, you know, for to truly be our next James Dean. And so in that way, tragically, I think River really fulfills that. But more than that, he had this quality of longing for me. Stand by me. The first time I saw him was so darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand. Stand by me.
Stand by me.
If the sky had read different that we look upon, that, you know, Stand By Me was based on one of the stories of that book. So I went not really knowing what to expect, and the character that I identified with really strongly in Stand By Me was the Will Wheaton character. I think that's by design, but also by circumstance. He was super skinny and, you know, kind of vulnerable and wanted to be a writer, and all those things were kind of floating around in my head at that time, you know. And so to have a friend like Chris, who River Phoenix plays in Stand By Me, was something that I had in my life. I felt, you know, my best friend Carrie from first grade, we're still best friends, you know. He was best man at my wedding and I wasn't his. He took me under his arm. He's, you know, the toe-headed kid from America, who, you know, who blonde and blue-eyed and perfect in my eyes in every way. And I there was a longing in me as a little Chinese kid that I wanted to look like that and be like that and be that comfortable. But without that, I had this friend who would protect me and who would speak up for me. You know, I was okay. Hey, don't pick on him. He's all right. And Chris was that character to Stand By Me, and I loved Chris, and you know, not a romantic love, but the sort of desperate love that you feel when you're a kid for your friends. And I loved him like a friend, you know. The way that he took care of him, and you could see throughout the course of the film that nurturing quality of River Phoenix's, that I don't think that you can fake that.
But I discovered Phoenix, and what he will always be the most important to me for is Stand By Me, which is a movie I saw when I was 12, like just the exact right age to see it.
Yeah.
I was homesick and I had the flu, so I was home for a week. and my parents had a copy of Stand By Me on VHS, and it was rated R. And my mom said, oh, but you can watch that. It's, you know, it's R, but it's okay for a 12-year-old. That was a big deal. And then you watch that movie, and you've seen it?
Oh, many times.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That might be, like, my most watched movie. Well, this one was one my parents had, like, five tapes, and this was one of them. Yeah. And it was a Stephen King thing. Like, it was my first exposure to Stephen King, which was so exciting. But all three of those, there's four characters, and the three non-Phoenix characters all sort of resonated with me. There was the, you know, the sensitive writer. There was the, you know, I don't want to be ableist or body shame anybody, but the slightly
doughy.
Overweight,
doughy.
The doughy, you know, goofy kid, which I also was. And then like the class clown, which I also was. And I sort of ignored Chris because Chris was like the tough guy and very much sort of like the characters in the movie do, the adult characters sort of like, oh, well, that's the kid who's, you know,
he's trouble
on the wrong. He's trouble. He's on the wrong side of the tracks. And we see what Chris becomes, and he becomes a lawyer and, you know, escapes his circumstances. But during the text of the film, he is there as like the tough guy. He's got the cigarette rolled in his shirt and he, you know, all of that stuff. And it wasn't until years and years and years later, like as an adult, that I really recognized what an influence he had on me in terms of what he showed, how sensitive boys can be.
Yeah.
And so by extension, men, but in that movie, it's boys. He is, you know, he hugs his friends and he cries with his friends. And when his friends are trying to be dudes, you know, and sort of brush off their feelings, he's the one who stops and goes, no, we're going to talk about this. And it's so beautiful and it's so powerful. And like I say, it took me probably 25 years to be like, oh, I think out of any of them and maybe any movie character, just the influence he had on me. Oh my goodness. Well, the thing about him is he just, no matter who he played, he needed just, or he just innately had this immense sensitivity.
Yes.
And my other favorite movie of his, the one that sort of is tied to Stand By Me a little bit in my mind, is My Own Private Idaho,
right,
which is the other movie that he is so important to me in. And as we were getting ready to have this conversation, that was when I sort of realized the link in my two major River Phoenix performances is, again, just that like intense, like non-normative masculinity is the only way I can phrase it. It's there's a term that I think is really interesting and is maybe would bother people, but I find it interesting, so I'm going to say it out loud on the internet, which is the term feminized male.
Yes.
I use it a lot in my book, The Cinema of Paul Thomas Anderson, American Apocrypha, available now wherever you get your books. The idea
it's
of...
It's a great podcast that covers a lot of...
Yeah. Oh, good point.
Covers a lot of that
oh,
stuff.
Oh, my God. What a year last year was.
What a year last year was. Yeah.
The term non-normative masculinity... the term feminized male, rather, is... You can infer what it means. It's guys who project non-normative masculine tropes. And that is what he is in both of these movies, as the guy who cries so much and the guy who is just so like an aching heart on the outside of his body. That scene in My Own Private Idaho, which I have not watched as many times as Stand By Me, and it's been a little while, but the campfire scene. I really want to kiss you. It's just so beautiful.
I could love someone even if I, you know, wasn't paid for it. I love you and you don't pay me.
Mike.
I really want to kiss you, man.
Like got super excited to see him in Running on Empty. I love that movie with Christine Lonnie and Judd Hirsch, of course, about, you know, these 60s radicals that are on the run. But because of the choices that they made during the counterculture era, they kind of doomed their kid, River Phoenix, to also be on the run, and the choices that they make to kind of reintegrate him into society, even if it means separating from them. And from that film, I learned about 60s counterculture. That was not really a thing that was, you know, in my mind. I think the year after that, well, you know, not to overlook Explorers either, Joe Dante's Explorers.
Explorers, that was going to say, because that was another one that I didn't even realize probably that it was River, but I watched Explorers like relentlessly as a kid. I was like,
he plays kind of the Will Wheaton character in that one, because you know, you've got Ethan Hawke playing the Chris character from Steamboat. So he shows a little bit of range, but I think he shows the other part of his real charm in that one, is that his ability to really discover things.
Yes.
And you know, I talk about that with some actors sometimes, that the secret of their success is their ability to discover and to grow. And that's like Keanu Reeves, that's Matt Damon. These stars are only the best when they're discovering that they're Neo, or discovering that they're Jason Bourne.
Yes.
But, you know, they're so good at figuring out who they are. They have to be in the process of growth.
Yes.
If they appear in films fully grown, I think that's different.
Yes.
I think that doesn't work as well. That's why I still like the first John Wick more than the other ones, because the process of discovery for that, he still has it. Keanu is really
important. I'm thinking I'm back.
Yeah, exactly. He's like stretching the muscles, getting the kinks out. He's getting ready to go. And, you know, I think with River, there was that too. And you see that a lot in Sneakers. Just him thinking.
Yeah.
Just him realizing. At the end of it, when he realizes he can go on a date with a pretty agent, I mean, even that moment, he takes a beat, an extra moment to think about, to process. And between the processing and the empathy, you get this portrait of an actor, of a character, of a persona that's absolutely lovable. That's absolutely like embraceable, that you say, he's working it out. I'm working it out. He cares about other people. I care about other people.
Yeah.
And he also looks like this. He doesn't have to be any of those things. He could just be James Franco. He could just be a meathead if he wants to be. But he isn't. There's an extraordinary depth. Who else could play a young Indiana Jones? With him, with, you know, smirking, that little smirk, more than any other thing that he does physically throughout the course of the prologue, he does a little smirk in it that Harrison Ford does, another actor who's so good at discovery,
yes,
so good at like realizing, like when, you know, Marion kisses in Return of the Jedi, when he realizes that he doesn't have a rival in Luke. That, you know, that Leia loves him romantically, the beat that Harrison Ford takes, and then the smile that dawns on his face, that's got to be the same kind of element that drew them, besides River being huge at the time, but drew him to an actor like River Phoenix, the sense of discovery. I love him in Mosquito Coast. I love him, and I adore him in Dogfight.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
The Mosquito, like, you talk about this sort of, I don't know, like, almost uncharted range. It's like Mosquito Coast. Peter Weir does Witness and Mosquito Coast with Harrison Ford, and you're like, man, you know, they were on a frequency there. And then the kind of absolutely like almost cannibalistic relationship that Harrison Ford's character has with his children in that movie, and you see their amazing relationship, and you also see this deep empathy from his eyes that actually makes his father look admirable in a movie that we as the audience are thinking that he's nuts for 90% of it, because we're seeing the peril that he's putting his family in. And for Harrison Ford to kind of clock him in that movie and talk to Steven Spielberg and George Lucas and go, that's me. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that's me when I was a kid. I'm that kid. That Absolutely. Is like that. I've never forgotten how important that was. And such a quality to be like, oh my God, yes. Like that's the wry smile and the discovery.
Consider the burden that River Phoenix has to carry in Mosquito Coast.
Yeah.
Right. As Charlie, and his parents are Helen Mirren and Harrison Ford. I mean, he's instantly sort of shoved into this place of royalty, right?
Yeah.
And he's got to your point, he's joining a crew with Peter Weir and Harrison Ford, who've already knocked it out of the park in one of the most honored films of the 1980s with Witness. And so here's Mosquito Coast. And I think the hardest job in the film is not, you know, not Harrison Ford's Mania, which he plays wonderfully. He's really
wonderful.
Really, but it's River who has to carry this sort of burden of worship for his father and love and respect and desperate longing for his father that curdles and begins to change. And he realizes that, and he never stops, I don't feel like, loving his father, but he has to begin to protect his siblings, his younger siblings. Yeah. And he takes on sort of a leadership role and moving them away from the situation, which is obviously painful for him and obviously necessary. The range that he has to undergo, it's really his movie, I think, River Phoenix's movie. But, you know, he can do comedy. And
yeah,
I love You to Death. You know, obviously, yeah. Kevin Klein's ridiculous accent and everything. But, you know, River Phoenix paired again with Keanu Reeves, you know, to say, like, you know, I think maybe that's the first time they're paired together. But there's something magical in that pairing, too, because they're both similar actors in terms of their strength. But River Phoenix seems to have a different kind of intellectual depth. And yes. I'm not, you know, throwing aspersions on Keanu Reeves, but his screen persona is not that. I don't buy him as things other than what he is, you know, just the chosen one. And he's the chosen one. I would vote for him for president. You know, there's something very pure about Keanu Reeves. With River, there's more contemplation.
Yes.
There's more period of discovery, you know. With Keanu Reeves, like, whoa, and then he's there.
Yeah.
You know, with River, there's thinking, there's a tilt of the head as if he's sniffing the wind. Yeah. Or, you know, testing the tension on the surface of the water. He's cautious in a touching and precious, I think, way. But, you know, I love him and love You to Death. It's a smaller thing. And then My Own Private Idaho is the movie that really blew my mind about River Phoenix, because, you know, I was raised in a very conservative part of Colorado. One of my first exposures ever, probably, to any kind of homosexual imagery. And yes. Here he's playing kind of a gay hustler in this beautifully conceived film, beautifully shot, wonderfully written, based on Shakespeare, and, you know, drive travelogue across the United States, and riding on the back of a motorcycle with Keanu Reeves smoking a cigarette with red sunglasses. There's, come on, you know, in terms of aspirational red denim jacket, James Dean stuff, that's it.
That's it.
I started wearing patterned shirts after that. You know? and my dad would have put me on the sidewalk if he knew that I was emulating, you know, a gay hustler from a movie, from My Own Private Idaho. But, you know, from there to playing like a crew cut Marine, you know, going off to war and dogfight, but all of it's anchored with this sort of this sense of discovery and self-discovery, especially, and longing for something. They're looking yes. for something. And the relationship between he and Lily Taylor, Dogfight, is it's still foundational for me. The kindness after the initial cruelty, the realization scene in Dogfight when he sees the depth of how he's hurt her,
yes.
and how he goes after her and they go walking and talking. That's the growth of every one of us, I hope, right?
Yeah.
As young men who are awful, into young men who are better. And I'm working on it.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you talked about Dogfight, because that's a movie that feels like it's finally getting its flowers. Like right now in 2024, as we're talking, like so many people, as the announcement, you know, as it happens, the great still physical media companies that curate something or bring something back, and you just hear this outpouring of love of like how cherished something is, and you're like, oh, I didn't know you cherished that. Like I cherished it, and I think that as a text. You know, I like to say of myself, before anyone else, until I was like 25, I was a high functioning ape. You know, really. You know, like, because that's what happens when you're a young man. Like, you're not very developed, but you then start really trying, and like, and it's that pursuit of trying and failing and growing up around other men who are cruel and having to survive, and then you sometimes taking on those things or whatever your environment or your relationships are, you get amongst bad crowds, etc. But it's like moving beyond those things to who you actually are. And that's such a beautiful movie for that, which is like, we can be better. Like, and he is that guy. That discoverability is like, we can be better than this. And he has something that he just has, he cans that quality, and it's so hard to project it right into the hearts of the audience. But he had that. He had that.
Yeah, and imagine a young actor with the courage to play such a repulsive kind of behavior, yeah, right? Yes. Even if he's redeemed, yeah, obviously. But even to do that, he's 21 years old in Dogfight, I think. And to have the sort of presence to say, I don't really care if I'm a hero. I don't really care if I have flaws and major flaws. This seems real and human to me, and I'm going to do it. And yeah, here we go. In 1991, he could probably kind of dictate what he wanted to do.
And, you know, this, yeah, is by after that point.
Indiana Jones is after, you know, right around the timeline, probably, I know, I guess. But he was choosing, I'm going to be a gay hustler, and then I'm going to be a guy who's really mean to Lily Taylor. Who could ever do that? You know, I'm going to be these things. and, you know, to your point about the blockbusters and the indie things, he was the guy that really brought the same quality to both. He seemed, you know, he deepens the big movies he's in, and he is of a kind with the smaller movies he's in. And Sneakers, for me, kind of occupies a middle space between big blockbuster kind of feeling film, heist film, and the small independent picture. That it's very much like movies like Rafifi and stuff that I was, yeah, first discovering, you know, in college, as I was trying to figure out, you know, what's going on with the French here? What, you know, wait a minute, he's American? Why is he calling himself this? And so there's all of the stuff that's happening in Sneakers that's very touching to me too, about this period of my life. We're really discovering and loving these French heist movies. But yeah, but you know, going to Sneakers again, just like with Running on Empty, me discovering kind of the 60s counterculture for the first time, more elements of that with Sneakers, to your point, I think you're making earlier about, who is this guy exactly, Sidney Poitier? Who is this, yeah, guy exactly? You know, yeah, and I wonder if, I know that Sneakers is the first time I saw David Strathairn in something.
Yes.
You know, and of course, being a huge John Sayles fan, you know, I wonder if my entry point to John Sayles might not have been David Strathairn. I don't even remember that now at this point. But, yeah, you know, and Mary McDonnell, I was a huge, as everybody was at that time, don't judge me for, I love Dances with Wolves.
I love Dances with Wolves. I'm not gonna be that person that is, she's the best thing.
Oh my God.
Besides Wes Studi, she's the best thing in that movie.
She is so good in that movie. And you know, and I loved Ben Kingsley from Gandhi. I watched that. That was one of the movies I watched as a kid. I loved it. And of course, Ghostbusters was a big movie for me when, yeah, I was a kid.
There's
Dan Aykroyd. But there's all these people. So who's Sidney Poitier? Why is he such a big deal?
Yeah.
There's all these people. So who's Robert Redford? Why is he in the top billing? It's exactly what's the... I've seen him maybe, you know. But it deepens your curiosity and everything. And I think River Phoenix was just like kind of the entry point for me anyway at that age, and to say, God, I'll watch anything I'll watch with River in it. That was the year that I graduated from high school, 1991. And so a couple years after this was like, you know, freshman years in college, where I'm watching Sneakers and thinking, man, this is like an old Hollywood get together, put on a show kind of piece. And I really need to get smarter about these other people. And so, you know, River Phoenix was also kind of a teacher then in that way, where he's sort of like, if it's good enough for River to do, I'm going to take it seriously. I'm going to take seriously what these other people are doing and what they're up to. And so, yeah, there's, you know, I don't want to over-romanticize River Phoenix. And, the, you know, there's a real danger, I think, you know, people roll their eyes and like, oh, this guy, whatever. But I think just my introduction of him and Stand By Me and the sense that I had throughout his whole short life of real longing for him.
Yeah.
Like, I want things to work out for him. I felt like he was a friend that, you know, I could almost talk to. I could almost pick up the phone and talk to. And he would listen. You know, that's the crucial
part. That's the thing. He's like, he would listen.
Yeah, he would answer.
Yeah.
Right? And if he needed him. And you know, I've of course never met him. I've never met anybody's family. I have no real connection to him, except that all of the roles that he played made me feel as though he wasn't acting. It made me feel as though he were genuinely curious about the world and about other people, and that he was the kind of person that could be maybe trusted.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he's gone from us at the age of 23. And that's just like, it's unimaginable, the loss of that. And I'm still not sure, even with the unimaginable losses we've suffered since then, I'm not sure I've ever felt one quite as deeply as that one. Yeah, I still remember when I heard about it, and, you know, appropriately enough, he died on Halloween. So, you know, I still remember this, and I remember, like, how could it be? How could this, you know, the best of our generation, how could this have happened?
Yeah.
And perhaps it's only doomed to happen to the best of our generation, right? Is that, that, you know, was that Allen Ginsberg poem, Howl, you know, that it's the best minds and the best people of our generation that are always ground up by it. Yeah, but that's my longish spiel about River Phoenix.
Here's the final word for Lee Zachariah.
Like, it is kind of amazing that they managed to get Phoenix for this, like, in this moment. Like, he's just been young Indiana Jones. He's just been in My Own Private Idaho, which, you know, the two biggest calling cards you could have. He's right on the verge of being the biggest young movie star in the world, and yet here he is in a goofy supporting role, the lovelorn outcast teen who suddenly found himself hanging out with guys old enough to be his father. Like, what is he doing here? Like, it is not... If you're this guy's agent, you say, no, you go and do the Oscar-winning art house films, or you do the big movie star films. Like, sticking him in this ensemble is just such a strange choice for him. And I'm so glad he did it, because, like, he's so good in it. Like, you're not seeing River Phoenix, the movie star. You're not seeing, like, all the weight that comes with his legend. You are just seeing Carl. And for a guy, like, forget about movie stars you've been watching for three decades disappearing into roles. For this guy, who is, like, even now better known for his legend than anything else, like, River Phoenix is such a... It's more about who he was than the roles he played. He still disappears into that role. You still watch it and you see Carl and you see him as this goofy teen. You know, it's one of the best pieces of casting in this film, and I'm so impressed they pulled it off.
This has been the fourth episode of Too Many Minutes, a Sneakers podcast. I've been your host, Blake Howard. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to keep following us along, make sure you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to check out what's happening on the website, you can go to oneheatminute.com. If you want to reach out to us, email us at mail@oneheatminute.com. And if you want to support us, head on over to patreon.com/oneheatminute, and you can get a whole stack of exclusives. One Hot Take, our Patreon exclusive podcast, The Decade Project, months in advance before it comes onto the main feed, and video episodes of our latest mini mega series, which is almost over, Min Hunter. So get along, support us, and you'd be supporting not only this series, not only those series that are live, but next year's series in 2025, Row Min and the Min Cider. Very special thank you to my dear friend Lee Zachariah, Walter Chaw, Ethan Warren. Thank you so much. You can find links to their great work on the podcast show notes or on our website, oneheatminute.com, and just click on Too Many Minutes. And as always, a resounding and tremendous thank you for the participation and the endorsement of the legendary Phil Alden Robinson. We'll catch you on a special bonus episode of Too Many Minutes next week. Thanks for listening.
Over the last 75 years, over 10,000 chemicals have been introduced to our food supply. Yet the EU only allows 300 food additives. But at Thrive Market, we bring our members the highest quality brands and restrict more than 1,000 ingredients found at conventional grocery stores. Making the switch is easy with our Healthy Swaps scanner, which finds better versions of all your favorite pantry, snacking, and home essentials without the added junk, dyes, and fillers. Plus, it's all delivered straight to your door. So if you're looking to shop at a grocery store that actually cares about your health, go to thrivemarket.com/podcast and you'll get 30% off your first order and a free gift.